All right, y'all, welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/scotthortonshow. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. On the line, I've got the great Ramsey Baroud from PalestineChronicle.net, and he also is the author of These Chains Will Be Broken. Well, editor, I guess. These Chains Will Be Broken, Palestinian Stories of Struggle and Defiance in Israeli Prisons. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Ramsey?
I'm doing great, and thank you for having me, Scott.
Great, man. Happy to hear that, and very happy to have you back on the show. And meant to mention, of course, that we run almost all your stuff at antiwar.com as well. And we got a few of those to talk about on the show today. But first of all, I wanted to start with this story from the Palestine Chronicle. Israeli forces demolish emergency coronavirus clinic for Palestinians. I mean, it sounds so absurd that it must be true, I guess, in the northern Jordan Valley. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it is as absurd as it sounds, but it is really the typical type of behavior of the Israeli army. And it's foolish also to think about, and we'll talk about this in a second. But yes, there is this trend of the Israelis are trying to send political messages to the Palestinians. So whenever the Palestinians are trying to, contain the spread of coronavirus in certain areas that Israel claims to be part of its, future vision of the Israeli state. For example, yesterday in occupied East Jerusalem, they demolished a makeshift coronavirus clinic. They've done it in the Jordan Valley and so forth. So they're trying to send messages to Palestinians that you have no jurisdiction or any claim on these areas whatsoever. And even if you are sitting a makeshift clinic, you are as if you are trying to tell us that we have some sort of a claim over Jerusalem or the Jordan Valley. So they are making it very clear that they don't want Palestinians to operate within these areas whatsoever.
Yeah. And for the skeptics there, it was Israeli journalists who covered the story first, right, at Bet Salem?
Right. And, it's available. You see it in videos going viral all over. The Palestinians are good at anything. They are really good at documenting these kind of things. So it's not just mere eyewitness accounts. We see videos of these things happening. But the other foolish thing that's been also going on is that Israeli soldiers are also kind of unsettlers, are in this sort of spitting rampage, as strange as this may sound, where they are basically going to Palestinian, shops. ATM machines in particular have been the target of spitting, where they spit on the numbers and the knobs and the whatever they find, hoping that Palestinians, will contract the coronavirus. And it's just ridiculous, because that's not how the coronavirus operates. It doesn't understand the difference between, occupied and occupier and apartheid walls and checkpoints. It operates at a global level, but it just comes to show you this kind of really mean and destructive mentality that operates within the Israeli mindset, whether within the illegal settlers community in the West Bank or among Israeli soldiers in the West Bank as well.
Yeah. I'd read a story or two about the settlers spitting on Palestinians' cars as they're driving by and spitting down from the hilltops and that kind of thing. And, I guess we don't know for sure if those settlers actually have the COVID or not, right? But the point is, so imagine somebody was doing that to you and you don't know whether they've got it or whether they don't, but you have to presume that they do. And then what are you supposed to do?
Of course.
It's not like the Palestinians have a full supply of Lysol wipes for going to the ATM or whatever. They just have to turn around and go away. And that's if they don't get it in the face.
Exactly. And you know, and of course there is the insult connotation, you know, which this is a whole different story. I mean, this has been going on, and I documented these stories in a recent article I wrote about Israeli spitting. It's been going on for many years, especially in Jerusalem, where Christians have been kind of the target of spitting, and much of this has been reported in Israeli media, mostly really Haaretz, Jerusalem Post, Yodot, Ahronot have covered it, where Christians and women kind of find themselves as the main target of spitting by Israelis. And now it's kind of really expanding, you know, with this whole corona scare to include the entire West Bank as well.
Well, and all you got to do is put the shoe on the other foot for just one second. If it was the Palestinian Christians and Muslims spitting on Jews, Israeli Jews, including even settlers, much less, you know, inside so-called Israel proper, that would be terrorism with a capital T and probably sponsored by Iran.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, because this actually, that scenario you just raised, Scott, does exist. And in my research, I ran into this long feature published in the New York Times about Orthodox Jews in France, in few occasions being the victims of spitting, as well by others as an act of anti-Semitism. And the thing that's really and of course this is abhorring and it's terrible and it can't continue, but on the other hand, the New York Times not at all mentioned the, you know, the this history of spitting that's going on in Palestine, in East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem in particular, as if this happened completely in a vacuum and it was designated as it deserved to be designated as acts of anti-Semitism. And yet it's actually the Israeli media that have gave this issue so much coverage. And there are campaigns within Israel, within the Jewish community in Israel, trying to spit other, you know, stop other fellow Jews from spitting at Palestinians, whether Palestinian Christians or Muslims or women, including Jewish women who attempt to pray near the holy shrines in Jerusalem. So this is a story that has a lot of history, but to actually kind of think that this type of evil evolving with the coronavirus, giving them these new ideas and in new imagination to how do we actually spread the virus amongst Palestinians by spitting at them collectively in Hebron, in Jerusalem, in Bethlehem, and so forth. It's absolutely ridiculous. But again, it's just part of this trajectory that goes back many years.
Well, but I mean, these Palestinians have invaded Judea and Samaria that it belongs to the Israelis from somewhere or something. And so these settlers are just defending themselves, I guess, Ramsey.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. That's the kind of narrative that the you know, the Zionists have been promoting for many years, despite the fact that we know where the Zionists actually came from, and you know, the mostly from Eastern Europe and all of this, and you know, how kind of this history was animated entirely out of scratch, and how Palestinians were completely dropped out of that history. So the history of my family, my parents, we go back thousands of years. I mean, there's no proof that we were anywhere in the world but there. And yet somehow we are completely skimmed over, you know, and you have this kind of strangely selected so-called history that negate our very existence and give those who came from Eastern Europe, you know, a few decades ago or a few years ago. I mean, many of the American Jews who come from Brooklyn and elsewhere and go to Israel and take on an Uzi or some sort of an automatic rifle, and then they have immediate historical claim. Immediate. You know, they get out of the airplane, and then suddenly there is this historical roots that go back, whatever, and people like me cannot even go home. I haven't seen my family for over 25 years now, and I don't see any hope of ever actually seeing them because they can't go, they can't leave, and I cannot go back. And this is the story of millions of Palestinians as well.
You know, I did an interview last night where they asked me about Israel, and it was an honest question from a good guy. It wasn't, you know, bent too prejudicial against the Palestinians necessarily, But just the point being that it came from a position of essentially, you know, the average American's confusion and ignorance and lack of understanding. And so it was an honest question, but it was so broad. It was like, what is going on over there anyway? Because all they know is that it doesn't really make sense. You know, they hear, for example, we've talked about this in the past. Palestine is the state next door that has invaded Israel and is using terrorism to extort land out of them and all this stuff. Oh, and also it's up to the Israelis to decide if one day the Palestinians will ever get their own state. And these two things, you know, sit side by side and obviously completely and totally contradict each other. And yet no one ever really hashes it out. No one ever really explains. And as I was saying to those guys last night, you know, if you just look at a map of Israel, it looks like somebody invaded from the east and took this giant chunk of Israel away from them, the West Bank, when in fact that's what's left that hasn't been completely conquered yet. And so, right. But they'll never explain that really on TV. You know, it was on MSNBC once 5 years ago where they explained this, but never since then. So the average just TV viewer would think that the whole story is, you know, Minas Tirith under siege by the forces of Mordor from the east. And there's nothing, there's no backstory to it. There's nothing that you need to understand better than that. And then even when it doesn't make sense, you still don't get clarity. But meanwhile,
even if you try to give them clarity, they wouldn't accept it. For example, I have many stories I can tell you about my relationship with mainstream American media, but a recent one was with the New York Times. A few months ago, they asked me to write an article explaining the context of the Great March of Return, you know, where tens of thousands of Palestinians go to the fence separating besieged Gaza from Israel and protesting and demanding their right of return to their ancestral homes. So I tried to do that. I thought I did a very good job at it.
You're a good writer.
Thank you, Scott. But also keeping in mind that I'm dealing with the New York Times and their editors and their audience. So I'm trying to kind of find some sort of a really balanced but an honest way of conveying the truth. And no. Right. We don't want history. You need to tell us about Hamas and Fatah, you know, the Palestinian rival factions. And I said, okay, this is fine. I will discuss this, but it has to be placed within historical context. What happened in 1948? How did these kids become refugees? How did their families become refugees? What are their... They would not accept it. It carried on. I had to rewrite the article over 10 times. And it carried on for nearly 2 months. And at the end, they said, nope, thank you. We don't want it. You know? So, and yet, if you are... an Israeli right-wing politician or whatever, making all sorts of bizarre claims, they get published in the New York Times, no questions asked. If you are Ramzi Baruch trying to convey really basic, well-known information documented not only by Palestinian historians and world historians, but by Israeli historians, the likes of Ilan Pappe, the likes of Avi Shlim, the likes of Miko Peled, so many of them are saying the exact same thing. You are barred. You are not allowed. Yeah. We want you, Ramzi, to tell us about the conflict amongst your own people. Forget about Israel. Israel is not to be touched or criticized in any way on the pages of the New York Times. So this is no wonder why people ask what seems to me basic or you know, supposedly stupid questions. They are not. They are basing that based on the knowledge that is available to them through mainstream media.
Right, exactly.
And the mainstream media is not telling them anything.
That's exactly it. And, you know, it's funny, too, because in this case, too, here, explain to me the March of Return. Well, I mean, God dang, it's got return right in the name of the march. Return to what? From where? You know, as you're saying, the population of the Gaza Strip is something like 80% of the population of the Gaza Strip are refugees. Well, refugees from where? You're not allowed to say where they're refugees from and where they're trying to return to?
God forbid. It's you are exceeding your mandate. You need to tell us why Palestinians are dysfunctional. Fine. I am ready to tell them why we have factional rivalries. I never shy away from, you know, I follow the ideas of Edward Said, the Palestinian, great Palestinian historian, and Professor Edward Said, who said, any criticism always has to start with the self to be a genuine criticism.
Right. Yeah, and of course, you know, and all the time I've known you, you have no problem criticizing Fatah or Hamas. You've never been loyal to either side, either faction in that whatsoever.
Exactly. But you can't just simply come and say, oh, my society is dysfunctional and Israel is the greatest democracy in the world. I mean, you have to really put things in the proper context, and yet we have no space. I mean, you mentioned my book about the prisoners. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
But do you think that I will ever expect any mainstream newspaper anywhere in the United States or even Europe to actually run a review or a write-up about it? We are, as Palestinian intellectuals, and forget about me, I don't want to use myself as an example, think of the great Edward Said, but also think of Norma Salha and Gada Carmi and these great historians and novelists. They almost never, ever get space in any their books, their writings, their ideas, their theories. We are invisible to mainstream media. They yeah. don't acknowledge our existence on the intellectual map. So how can people ever understand things from our point of view if you have this quarantine on our ideas
yeah.
and our intellect? You see?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and you know, I mean, here's the thing too, and this is, believe me, just descriptive, not normative here, but it is understandable, and I mean that in the literal sense, understandable. Not, I can sympathize with the point of view, but just, it's understandable that in 1948, Arabs are just a bunch of towel heads and sand N-words and... they just don't matter. They're just, you know, like American Indians or Black Africans, or where they can be pushed out of the way and not respected in the way that European Jews, even though they were Jews in the social rank of things back then, they're whiter than you guys. And so that counts for something. And it's the last hurrah of white settler colonialism. We're outlawing invading other people's countries and transferring your populations into those countries, except for this one last exception here for the survivors of the Holocaust. We're going to move them down there, and we're just going to pretend like these Palestinians don't exist. I mean, I think I told you before about Eric Margolis talked about how at the time his mother was a great journalist in the Middle East, and there was a total cover-up about the Nakba. It was denied that the Palestinians even existed at all. And when his mother reported that, yeah, there are millions of people who are now refugees on the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip here who are suffering from this thing, that are, you know, hundreds and thousands of them who've been removed from their homes, almost a million, three quarters of a million people, that, you know, they threatened to kill her and threatened to kill him when he was a young boy at the time. That this was a crazy conspiracy theory that these people even existed. But anyway, you could see the rationalization there, that the Jews are whiter, the European Jews, and they just survived the Holocaust, the ones who did survive it. And so, okay. But the point I'm trying to get to is, yeah, but now it's 2020. And we're at the absolute epitome of anti-racist political correctness in the West here. And even to insane degrees, beyond reason, the political correctness in a lot of ways. And so it's not understandable now the way that people just pretend that you're not dealing with a system of Jim Crow or South African style apartheid at the expense of the natural human rights of millions of innocent people who are essentially suffering in this situation simply because their parents, you know, gave birth to them while having the wrong religion. And for no other crime, and who, you know, they're sitting here talking about, yeah, we're going to go ahead and start annexing what's left of the West Bank. You can't even have your measly 22% of what's left. You'll be lucky if you get 22% of 22%. And somehow, as you're saying, you can't get an essay in the New York Times. You can't get, you know, leftists, obviously leftist media. Yes. But, you know, mainstream progressive and liberal media to pay attention to this. No dice whatsoever. And in the university setting, I know you could tell me about that. The uphill battle that Palestinian voices have to climb to even be heard here at all. It would be like if we just refused to pay any attention to the American Indians on the reservation, or even keep attacking them and refuse to even hear their voices about what's going on, or something that, you know, continuing Jim Crow segregation in the South up to 2020 even, and refusing to go ahead and implement Brown versus Board of Education after all this time. And it's completely bananas. And yet it just continues. And frankly, it's hard for me to understand. I mean, as you mentioned, in Israel, you have Israeli Jews trying to stop other Israeli Jews from spitting on Palestinians. In America, there are huge numbers of American Jews who absolutely resent Israel and detest and support a two-state solution and all that kind of thing. And yet still, even their voices don't really get heard by the mainstream at all. It's really remarkable in its own way. You know, I'm kind of fascinated by the success of the propaganda and of the propaganda by omission, maybe more than anything else.
Exactly. And, you know, Scott, there's an excellent essay by the late Edward Said, since I mentioned his name twice, in our chat, called Permission to Narrate. It was published in 1984, and it was discussing more specifically how the Israeli war on Lebanon was dealt with in American mainstream media, and how any voice that seemed to object to what Israel was doing in Lebanon, the illegal war, the massacres, and all of this, in 1982, how it was completely, these voices were muffled or marginalized or completely blockaded from presenting a counterpoint of view to what the Israeli propaganda machine was spewing worldwide. And it's just how sad it is that essay could actually be read in not in 1984, but rather in 1948 or read 2020 and still applies. So that you have a so-called conflict. They speak of a conflict. Mainstream media doesn't hesitate to call it a conflict, fine. Yet somehow, one of these so-called conflicting parties, which is us Palestinians, are not to be allowed to speak. You can't hear our voices. We don't exist. And therefore, oh, and not just that, but also any Israeli or any Jewish person anywhere in the world who seem to side with the Palestinians or say, wait a minute, they do have a point, they do have rights, that person is immediately smeared as a self-hating Jew. And now it's beyond cultural and societal smearing. It went as far as a few years ago, the Israeli Knesset, the parliament, began producing laws not targeting Palestinians only, but targeting dissenting Jews within Israel, preventing them from accessing state money and state funds, non-for-profit organizations being shut down. And the Israelis find themselves also prevented from challenging any governmental narrative. So this goes beyond Jews and Arabs, Jews and Palestinians. This is something that this is a fight between the Zionist narrative that hijacked the Jewish cause entirely and claimed to speak on behalf of all Jews, and against anybody else who dares reject this narrative, including Israelis and Jews themselves, yeah. Right? And so this is so important for us to emphasize that this is not a fight with these well-defined racial, religious, and ethnic lines. It is really about the narrative itself. So if you are pro-Israel, Christian, fundamentalist in Washington, D.C., you are as Zionist as Israel wants you to be, and you could be very much a religious Israeli Jew who is against what Israel is doing, and somehow you are not a member of the tribe, and you are completely marginalized and neglected, and in fact punished at times.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, the polls I've seen say that the majority of American Jews support independence for the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and a Palestinian state. I think it's even a third of American Jews don't identify with Israel in any real way or think about it whatsoever. Is one of the answers on the multiple choice. Is Israel even an issue in your life at all? And the answer is shrug. No, I'm an American. What do I care about Israel? And then if they do care about Israel at all, most Jews are liberals and progressives. And so they think, well, yeah, there should be civil rights for minorities. That's kind of one of the things about being a liberal in America, right, is supporting civil rights. So it's a very loud and very determined minority who, you know, are determined to frame things the way that they do and have succeeded to such a great degree. It's again, it's really remarkable. It's as remarkable as it is, you know, tragic for the people of Palestine. And then, so speaking of which, that includes you, as you said, you're from there. You didn't just, you weren't born of Palestinian parents in the West. You're from Palestine. And then I was trying to remember, actually, as I was reading this great article at antiwar.com, A Palestinian Guide to Surviving a Quarantine on Faith, Humor, and Dutch Candy. Great piece here. And I was trying to remember if your family were refugees from another part of Palestine, or whether they were from Gaza all along, or what, and how it was that they had ended up in the Gaza Strip. And then, but if you could just tell us, you know, you can stick with the theme of the piece if you want, but it just brings up so much about what life was like there in the Gaza Strip for you as a boy.
Right. And that was really the idea I wanted to convey. I've seen a lot of, you know, people are shocked by all of this, of what's happening and the quarantines and the lockdowns and the tragic death tolls and all of this. And I just didn't want to pile up. I didn't want to approach this story from, oh, yeah, well, you know, we have suffered a lot more. Look what it's happening in Gaza and Yemen and Libya and so forth. I didn't want to approach it from that point of view. I wanted kind of like an honest, a human touch, but also with a spin of humor in it as well, because I think people relate more sometimes to this type of narrative. So it was like, okay, well, you know, I can tell you a few tips from, you know, my past on how to survive this type of situation. And, you know, it's relative. You know, a lot of these things may apply to you, may not apply, but I will, you know, kind of use my own story growing up as a refugee in the Gaza Strip. My family come from a village that was destroyed by the Zionist militias in 1948. It's called Beit Daras. Beit Daras is a village that, when I wrote my book, my father was a freedom fighter. I managed to trace it back to over 1,000 years, and beyond that, I really couldn't find any sources that would kind of confirm its existence. But I there was no reason to believe that it hasn't been there for over 1,000 years, and like nearly a million Palestinian who were expelled in 1948 by the Zionists, my family ended up coming to the Gaza Strip, where we pitched a tent and we started a life there as Palestinian refugees, an identity that remains part of our identity until today. And the strange thing is that even though I'm a U.S. citizen now, I still see myself as a Palestinian refugee, because we don't see the refugee experience in terms of, you know, the need for humanitarian aid. It becomes more like a political identity for us. As long as I'm a refugee, as long as I'm still fighting for the rights of my people to go back home, that sort of thing. During the first Intifada, that's the Palestinian Popular Uprising of 1987, Israel used all sorts of harsh collective punishment measures against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, and the West Bank. I was living in the Gaza Strip with my family. I was a teenage boy. And we lived in a refugee camp that really was one of the hardest hit areas in terms of, we were quite rebellious. We protested all the time. We demanded our rights all the time. We even threw rocks at the Israeli army that constantly invaded our camp. And as a result, I would say within the 7 years of Intifada, I would say maybe I was home constantly for anywhere between 3 to 4 years, not leaving the house, period. And the other 3-4 years, I would say that we were not allowed to venture beyond our neighborhood. So it's kind of like 7 years of almost complete lockdown. So, you know, you would think that you kind of learn a few things from that experience, that when the lockdowns started here in Seattle, where I'm speaking to you right now, for me, it was like, okay, I need to revert to an experience that helped us survive during these difficult times. And of course, the first thing that comes to mind was the Intifada and how we managed to survive these 7 years of complete quarantine, if you will. That's the idea behind the article.
Yeah, well, and sure sounds like a pretty terrible childhood there. And, you know, the way it starts here with the announcement in poor Arabic that stay inside. Anybody who comes outside after dark will be shot. And yeah, the IDF, they mean it when they make a threat like that. That's a promise. And I guess you probably must have seen the results of them following through on that promise probably pretty often at that time, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, I've lost dear friends of mine during that time, you know, just students, you know, pupils at school. My classmate, Ala, was one of the one who was shot. He was my football buddy. We always played what we call soccer, you call football here in the U.S. Together. He was this tiny little kid. He was so very smart and very well. Very well behaved and polite, and we were just coming home from school, you know. So schools would open for a couple of days, and they would shut them down for 2 months and so forth. And we were excited to go back to school, at least, you know, for that time. And on the way back, the Israeli army cornered us near the neighborhood and opened fire, killing Ala on the spot. So yeah, of course, you have numerous such stories, and I am being facetious when I compare, you know, that experience with the coronavirus quarantine. Of course, I mean, people here are not being shot dead in the street and so forth. But it was just kind of an attempt at, maybe even a desperate attempt at kind of getting people to relate to what we went through and what Gaza and Palestine are still going through until this moment.
Yeah, no, and it was, I think you did a good job on it. It should work. I mean, I'm already with you here, pal, but, you know, I think, you know, people are feeling extremely constricted right now, especially people who have lost their jobs. And the new numbers coming in this week say 20 million Americans have been thrown out of work in the last month. And all of us locked up in our houses like this, and a lot of people are really going stir crazy. And so, yeah, it should be a great opportunity for them. I mean, frankly, you know, what upper middle class life living Texan could even begin to imagine what it's like to be a Gazan, right? I mean, it's just, as we were talking about before, it's never in the media. They don't ever say, here's 60 minutes, here's 20 minutes of it is what it's like to be a Gazan for you here. And it's just completely outside of Americans' experience in any way. And so here's a small taste of that, you know, locked in your pretty nice house with your loving family, and still the groceries are delivered and everything is, you know, not falling completely apart yet. And yet think of how bad it already is, how afraid people are of this disease, of losing their ability to continue to provide for their families and everything else. And then there's just no question, this is just the smallest little taste of what it would be like to be a Palestinian under Israeli siege, and for years, for decades on end, where, you know, as you said, you can't even travel to go see your family, and they can't travel to see you. They're locked in there like a concentration camp, and for not committing a crime other than wanting their property back.
And I think that's another missing part of our narrative. And I encourage other Palestinian writers and intellectuals and ordinary people to understand that, you know, we could sit and debate, you know, the issue from a political point of view, from a historical, you know, comparative historical point of view and so forth. But, you know, until people actually appreciate what you go through at a personal level, they will never truly understand. And I think this is how the Israelis managed to really kind of coerce people into accepting their narrative. Hollywood played a huge role in kind of manufacturing that history that allowed ordinary Americans to sympathize with Israel without really fully or in any way understanding what Israel is actually is all about and what it's doing to Palestinians. I really do think that if ordinary Americans truly understand in a tangible way what is actually underway in Palestine, I think the vast majority of them will not allow their names, and they will not allow their numbers and stats to be viewed as pro-Israel in any way. So this is why it's so important for us to connect with ordinary Americans in a different way, at a human level. And I think the story really starts there. When my book came out, my father was a freedom fighter which did very well. I could not, even it took me by surprise of how many just ordinary people who's like, Ramsey, I saw this title, you know, my father died in Australia last year, and I saw this book and I bought it, and I know nothing about Palestine and Israel until I read this book. It was just relating to, you know, to his father, or someone else is relating to the love stories in the book, or the comedian of the refugee camp, and how ordinary people survive and thrive under the most difficult of circumstances. And I think it's so important that we connect at this level, because politics can be polarizing, and it's very, very difficult sometimes to change someone's built-in ideas if you don't really tap into that aspect in their brain or their hearts that connect them to you as a human beings.
Yeah, absolutely. Hold on just one second. Be right back. So you're constantly buying things from Amazon.com. Well, that makes sense. They bring it right to your house. So what you do, though, is click through from the link in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org, and I'll get a little bit of a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. Won't cost you a thing. Nice little way to help support the show. Again, that's right there in the margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, check it out. The Libertarian Institute, that's me and my friends, have published three great books this year. First is No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg. He was the best one of us. Now he's gone, but this great collection is a truly fitting legacy for his fight for freedom. I know you'll love it. Then there's Coming to Palestine by the great Sheldon Richman. It's a collection of 40 important essays he's written over the years about the truth behind the Israel-Palestine conflict. You'll learn so much and highly value this definitive libertarian take on the dispossession of the Palestinians and the reality of their brutal occupation. And last but not least is the great Ron Paul, the Scott Horton Show interviews 2004 through 2019, interview transcripts of all of my interviews of the Good Doctor over the years on all the wars, money, taxes, the police state, and more. So how do you like that? Pretty good, right? Find them all at libertarianinstitute.org/books. You need stickers for your band or your business? Well, Rick and the guys over at thebumpersticker.com have got you covered. Great work, great prices, sticky things with things printed on them. Whatever you need, thebumpersticker.com will get it done right for you. Thebumpersticker.com.
You know, it's been a little while since I've mentioned this, but there's this documentary by Max Blumenthal and Dan Cohen where two nice Jewish boys who went to the Gaza Strip after the assault, during the middle of the assault in 2014, and then stayed for the aftermath. And the whole movie is essentially just Dan Cohen sticking his camera in the face of local Gazans and saying, "So, what's on your mind?" And they talk about how they think and how they feel and what happened to them. And nobody says a thing about Allah said I should hate Jews and some garbage like Americans would assume. Every bit of it, they sound like a bunch of Texans, right? This is my land and you can't have it. You see this dirt? I'll fight you to the death for it. And this kind of thing. That's exactly what any citizen of any state in this land would say to a foreign occupier who comes to invade and confiscate their property, take it from them, slaughter them in a giant canned hunt like they do in the various, you know, repeated assaults on the Gaza Strip since the siege was declared, and all of this. And just seriously, they sound like any man in the world in the same situation saying the exact same thing. You know, it's, the essential humanity of it is just completely plain to see. That, you know, what are you so upset about? Well, they dropped a bomb on my apartment building and they killed 15 people, and so yeah, I'm mad. Pretty simple stuff. Let me ask you at the end here about COVID now. I mean, this has been a huge fear, I'm sure, of yours and everybody else's who cares about this, is what's going to happen when there's a real outbreak in the Gaza Strip? I mean, the West Bank, too, but in Gaza, obviously, the situation is far more desperate for, many more people. So how bad is it so far, and what, if anything, is being done?
Well, of course, Gaza is far more desperate because Gaza itself was struggling, and we've been writing about it, and Anti-War has been kindly publishing our work on the subject that Gaza has been already in a desperate situation in terms of the medical facilities that are lacking everything. Even clean water is not accessible to most of these hospitals and so forth. And now add to this the COVID-19. And I wrote an article about, I would say, 10 days before the breakout started in Gaza, saying, you know, you may think that Gaza, because of this political quarantine, the Israeli siege and blockade, you may think it's safer than the rest of Palestine or the rest of the world, perhaps. But once COVID-19 arrives there, it's going to be an absolute disaster, because I know that they have absolutely no preparedness, no facilities to deal with it. They couldn't even deal with basic diseases. With diarrhea, they can't deal with it. Imagine with the coronavirus strikes Gaza. The thing that worries me even most is not the number of cases that have been declared, is that they really have no way of knowing why people are dying or why people are getting sick, who has COVID-19 and who doesn't. Israel allegedly gave Palestinians 200, or Palestinians in Gaza, 200 testing kits. That's it. This is a population of 2 million people, and they were given only 200 test kits. And, of course, they ran out immediately. And not only now they have no way of knowing or testing or let alone treating, you have hundreds of people who have been quarantined, that they can't release them without testing them negative for the virus. So you have people who are trapped until WHO finds a way to convince Israel, perhaps, or to work with the Egyptians, or by some sort of a miracle, to actually allow more testing kits in Gaza. And even a few testing kits make it to Gaza again to hold Gaza over for another 24 hours. You're dealing with a protracted problem. And in my articles, I argued that if we can't liberate Palestine, at least the medical, the healthcare system in Palestine has to be placed under the authority of someone else, of the United Nations, of the World Health Organization, of any other entity that does not see helping Palestinians in terms of treatment and healthcare part of a political bargain. Israel is using this to bargain with the Palestinians. The Israeli Justice Minister actually just said that about a week ago. We reported on that in the Palestine Chronicle, saying to the effect of, listen, you have the bodies of two of our soldiers. For us, that's a humanitarian issue too. You want us to talk about COVID-19? For you, let's talk about our issues as well. So it's a complete tit for tat, complete swap. Release the bodies of our soldiers, we release testing kits and so forth. So this is, I think, when the world recovers from COVID-19, I think Gaza will just be really going on its own trajectory. And we need to pay attention to it, because we know that this disease, if you don't care about Palestinians per se, or you don't have sympathy for the people in Gaza, you have to think that this is a disease that travels. And it doesn't just, it will travel through United Nations workers, through journalists, through, you know, so many other people who could possibly, you know, acquire and transmit the disease later on. So this is a very, very pressing issue. And sadly, it's not getting the kind of coverage that it needs, if any coverage at all.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess it could be an important turning point. You know, I don't know. I'm sure you saw where the Secretary General of the United Nations has proposed. And then apparently the actual veto holding members of the UN Security Council are close to agreement on a resolution declaring a global ceasefire in the name of this crisis, which I don't know if they're really going to do that or not. I mean, the story I read said Trump had signaled he'd support it. They were just going to try to talk to Putin next. They already had China on board for it. And who knows what that would really mean in practice, whether the Americans would, you know, I can't see them pulling out of Iraq and Syria all of a sudden based on it or anything like that. But at least it goes to show that, you know, the idea is apparent to everyone here that, you know, this crisis is a great kind of a clarifier about what it is we're doing, what counts as a national security threat, and what ought we be doing about those different threats and this and that. It's kind of time for a reassessment, where all this money's being spent, where our priorities lie. And So maybe it's an opportunity for people to, you know, expose themselves to the reality of the occupation of the Palestinians and to try to come up with a way to pressure the Israeli government to finally lift the siege, especially of the Gaza Strip here, and figure out a way to either, you know, force them from public opinion around the world to either grant the Palestinians independence on the West Bank of the Gaza Strip, or once and for all, admit that it's too late for that and go ahead and give them citizenship and figure out a new way forward in a single state solution type of a situation. Because, I mean, geez, it's been, what, 14 years, 13 years since they, well, 14, since they put the siege on over the election of Hamas back in 2006, where, you know, they're, you know, probably what, a huge percentage of the population of Gaza was born after that, right? Like a third of them or something, right, are too young. And of course, you know, half of them were minors then and didn't have the right to vote then. So assuming you're collectively punishing them for electing Hamas in 06, now you're talking about their parents and grandparents who did that, who, you know, the such a huge percentage of the people couldn't possibly, under any theory, bear responsibility for that. And in such a bad time of this disease and the threat of it, and as you said, the threat that if it's that bad in Gaza, it's going to continue to spread outside of there as well, that, you know, maybe there's an opportunity for a real rethink here along with everything else.
Absolutely. I mean, this is what we are hoping for. At least you have these useless conflicts in Libya and Yemen that are not going anywhere. And you use the magic word, opportunity. I mean, sometimes, you know, you are fighting a losing war, knowing it's a losing war, knowing that you have no strategic objectives anymore, but you are worried that if you pull out of this war, it might tarnish your reputation and your regional import and so forth and so on. Maybe this is their opportunity, saying this is not about strategic goals anymore. It's about protecting the world. We need to pull out of Yemen. We need to stop this nonsense in Libya and so forth. I hope that some countries do take advantage of this golden opportunity to save face and to stop these nonsensical wars that are killing tens of thousands of people for really no objective anymore.
Yeah. All right. Now, listen, I'm sorry I've already kept you so long, but can you just give us a real brief rundown here about this great piece that you wrote, Zionist Biden in His Own Words?
Right. So Joe Biden is kind of, you know, I remember when I think Jimmy Fallon in one of his comedy episodes many years ago referred to him as the drunken uncle. And then, you know, when he was the vice president of President Obama, and people laughed. And there was this thing that is quite amiable about Joe Biden, is that he's non-threatening. You know, he's not the kind of people you would kind of associate with vile Zionist racist ideas and so forth and so on. So I began researching the piece when Bernie Sanders was still in the race. And I, you know, everybody is discussing Sanders' views of Palestine, Israel, and Trump's views of Palestine, Israel, but Biden is kind of like as if he is not relevant to that discussion at all. And I kind of really tapped into something. I didn't realize what I was tapping into. One of the first pieces that I worked on was Biden giving a speech saying, you know, you don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist. I am a Zionist. And another one where he would give a speech in Jerusalem when he said, my name is Joe Biden and I love Israel. And I was like, okay, maybe this is just an opportunistic politician just trying to garner vote, money, support, and so forth. But then I kind of kept tracing his story all the way back to the early 1980s, where he has this very consistent pro-Israel line, anti-Palestinian line, all the way from then until today, over the course of 40 years, that has been a truly dedicated pro-Israel and, by his own admission, Zionist. And I kind of really wanted the reader to know, this is okay, you hate Trump or you want to bring change to your own country, but you have to understand that you are dealing with, you know, warmongering, you know, type of politicians who cannot possibly be the answer to whatever problems you are dealing with at the moment. So it ended up, I wrote two versions of this piece. There's a long version where I borrowed heavily from his speeches. And there was a more recent version that was published in Gulf News that followed the Bernie Sanders exit from the Democratic primaries. And the article is doing very, very well, which I'm hoping that it kind of opened the eyes of and minds of people to who actually Joe Biden is.
Yeah. You know, I wonder, this is probably a good question for Philip Weiss, who really specializes in this angle, but I wonder how much of the media consensus against Sanders and for Biden was based on Biden's Zionism. And Sanders, you know, he's been a Zionist, you know, in his life, of course, lived over there for a while. But under the influence of Matt Duss and others, it seems like he's gotten quite a bit better about this in the last few years. And I certainly know at least some anecdotes of American Jewish Zionist hawks absolutely cursing Sanders' name. I don't know how representative that is of the organized lobby, but it seems like quite a media consensus. And I'm no Sanders fan. Everybody listening knows I'm a libertarian here, but I'm just saying it was pretty obvious that the orders, just like in 2016, had come down from on high, that the media narrative will be that you may not choose this kook no matter what. And it sure worked. But I wonder how much of that do you think is because of the Israel lobby?
Well, there are two quick points I want to make. Number one is this is kind of really goes back to exactly what we were talking about earlier, that this the Zionist view of friend and foe is not really based on who's being who's Jewish and who's not. Because Netanyahu is absolutely enamored, he is absolutely in love with Joe Biden, and he just hates Bernie Sanders, despite the fact that Bernie Sanders is Jewish and Joe Biden is not. You see, so this is really comes to show you that what we're talking about is true. The Jewish element here is an element of political expediency and convenience and about historical narratives, but not the everyday reality. If you deviate, as Sanders has numerous times and eloquently so, from any, you know, adherence to the Zionist narrative, then he is considered this crazy guy who cannot be trusted. But then there's the other issue of electability. You know, we have been, you know, there's, I hate this term so very much. You know, the fact that, you know, is such and such electable, meaning does he conform to a mainstream media agenda of who is an electable and who's not? And Israel is one of the main issues that makes or breaks your chances of being electable or not. And I think from the very beginning, Bernie Sanders' electability was put in question because of the issue of Israel, that he is deviating so much from American foreign policy regarding Israel, to the point that in one of his speeches, Joe Biden, or rather one of his answers to a question during a Democratic debate, when Bernie Sanders took the side of the Palestinians and said Israel is a racist state, this is a racist government, referring to Netanyahu's government, Joe Biden tried to correct him. He said, I really hope that he didn't mean that. I really hope that it was just a slip of the tongue. It means that, you know, it's this crazy old man who just saying all these ridiculous things to the point that Biden didn't even want to engage with him. It's like, no, this is madness. It's not even worth engaging with. So you can imagine who is the electable from a mainstream American media's point of view.
Yep. All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you for staying on extra time with me here. I got endless questions, but I've got to call it quits at some point. But I really do appreciate you joining me again on the show, Ramsey, a lot.
Thank you very much, Scott, and keep up the good work, man.
All right. Stay safe out there, bud.
Thank you.
All right, you guys. Ramsey Baroud, he is journalist, author, and editor of the Palestine Chronicle. He's the author of 5 books, including My Father Was a Freedom Fighter, and the latest, These Chains Will Be Broken, Palestinian Stories of Struggle and Defiance in Israeli Prisons. And you can find what he writes at antiwar.com. The Scott Horton Show, Antiwar Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.